Hi, my name is Katie Leeson and I'm Managing Director of Social Chain UK, and welcome to my podcast, I Shouldn't Say This But. This week has been absolutely incredible for me as I have been announced one of the UK's top voices on LinkedIn. So if you are new to this podcast and you've come from LinkedIn, I want to say welcome and also explain a little bit about what the podcast is about. As a young female MD in a world where society is telling me that I should be an old man in a grey suit, I wanted to start a podcast to help break those barriers and talk about things that you wouldn't expect a managing director to say. So welcome to I Shouldn't Say This But. On this week's episode, I have a very special guest, TV's Emma Kenny, presenter, writer, and now recognised as one of the UK's leading TV psychological experts with regular features on This Morning. She is incredibly open and shares her story of grief. We also discuss how to deal with firsts, especially at Christmas when you have experienced loss, and how to reframe your brain to feel your worth and your power. We also discuss social media and the positives that that can have as a support system, tips for getting most out of your career, and also how society has given us a blueprint of how we should live our lives, but how that blueprint is broken. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of I Shouldn't Say This But. Thank you so much for joining us today. Today on the podcast, we have Emma Kenny, and she is a psychologist, and she's going to give us a bit of background about herself and how she got into psychology. Do you want to tell the listeners about you as a starting point?
Yeah, so thanks for having me, first
Thank
of all.
You.
Who am I? So my original training was in psychology, mm-hmm. and then many, many years in therapy. And then somewhere along the way, I stumbled into television, and I really did stumble into television. And since the last decade and just a little bit over, particularly since becoming a single mum, mm-hmm. I work more in the media. So I write the life column for Closer magazine. I'm the psychologist for This Morning. Tend to see me on the phone-ins there. I present crime shows. I've been building a health, fitness and wellness app for the past 4 years, which is ironic because it has nearly killed me. And on top of that, my main thing in life is I'm a mum. So I would say that right now in life, I'm both working in tech, media and therapy, which is my greatest love, apart from the kids and the animals. But that's me in a nutshell.
Wow. So a lot going on in your life.
There is a lot going on in everybody's life.
Yeah.
That's the key, right? Mm-hmm. That everybody, if they list what they're doing, at the end of it, you're like, I just need to go and sleep down. I just need to sleep.
Christmas is coming as well. That's when I'm going to sleep.
Yes.
What was it that first interested you in becoming a psychologist?
So I was sent to a psychiatrist and a psychologist when I was 13. Mm. I didn't like going to school. I found the whole education system really troubling. I'd gone from being in a working class primary school to winning a place at a private school. The private school was a great school, but it was a bit like going into a foreign country. You know, people have money, or at least I thought they did. You know, when you're a kid, you go into places with this whole set of assumptions. I think I was really assumption-based when I was a child. So I thought everyone was prettier. I thought everyone was richer. I thought everyone was brighter. I think I was right on the brighter bit, I'll be honest with you. I genuinely was like a fish out of water. And I just felt like I was a massively different human being. And on reflection now, I can see that actually a lot of girls felt that way, but it was so different for me, the transition. So by 13, I just decided that I would either sleep in the sick room, I would not go into school at all, or I would play pool with whoever I could find down the local pool hall. And understandably, school were a little bit unhappy with that and felt that I might need some help. And so they sent me to a psychologist and a psychiatrist. Psychiatrist assessed me as really well, just a little bit quirky. And the psychologist saw me for 2 years. And during that experience, I probably became more mentally unwell. And they did so little to help me that it stunned me that you could even be in a position where you had young people, but you didn't know how to talk to them. And at the end of every session, he would get my mum in. And for the last 15 minutes of the session, he would talk about what we talked about. And I remember going home when I was probably at 14 and a half and saying to my mum, I think I could probably do that job. And she was like, yeah, you should probably do that job. And I was like, oh, a bit of praise there. I'll go and do that job then. And that's how I ended up in psychology. The fact that I'm really nosy, I feel that I see solutions, not problems. So when people explore things with me, it feels a very simple transition to see an opening as to how they can move forward. So I guess I got into it through experiential and also through vocational desire and ended up in this position now. And it's amazing because it's like social media has happened in the meantime, which means that also now my reach is massive.
Yeah.
It's great.
So do you think that it's moved along now? If you'd found that when you were 13, you didn't get the support you needed, has the whole system changed or do you think it still needs work?
I think anybody in mental health says the system is just fundamentally flawed in lots of ways because as we become more aware, so too does people desire more, and rightfully so. So back in the day, me going to a psychologist, it was seen as something that was for crazy people. And even though I was fully sane, the point was the assumption was based in this idea that if you had a mental health issue or that you were concerned about your mental health, by the time you got to see a psychologist, you know, there was an acute reason. It's moved on in that way. But now because we know a lot more about mental health and wellness, and rightfully so, particularly Generation Zers, you know, this whole new capacity of communication, yes, it means that people understand it more and see it as less stigmatized, but the reach really isn't there because there's so many people want it. And then when it comes down to young people, I think that CAMHS is brilliant and there are lots of organisations such as the Tavistock Clinic, let's say, for gender dysphoria. There are all of these things that are growing, but I wouldn't say that everybody's naturally inclined to know how to work with young people. I have this big problem with the way that we communicate with young people, particularly teenagers, and it's really strange. It's like people suddenly start using a different language and they start speaking to them in a different voice, you know, or they start condescending or patronising them too. And I think that sometimes we've got to understand that the whole communication process with young people and with people who need therapy and teenagers particularly need to change. It really does need to change. But, you know, I'm not going to say negative things because there's amazing people out there doing amazing things, but it's hard to get the access. It's really hard. And people tend to be acute. So it's acute phase. And we really need to get right in at the beginning.
Yeah, we offer here, I was talking to you before, we offer opt-out therapy.
It's crazy, it's amazing.
I know, and I'm so proud that we can do that because I've obviously seen benefits myself from seeing my therapist. But one of the things that we are debating over whether we should call it therapy, whether we should normalise the word, whether we should change the word to make people feel like it's not the last step and you can only go when there's something really wrong with you. So it's a topic that it's that word, I think, has sometimes got negative associations with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the problem is that we've got this massive distinction between mental and physical health, which is ridiculous because mental and physical health are exactly the same. So we divide the head from the body, which is just ridiculous. The brain cannot feel. It has nerve endings that don't affect that way. So like if I hurt my arm, then my brain can reference that because there's all these nerve endings and it's a reactionary experience. And I know my arm's in trouble, but the brain can only transmute its problem with emotional experience. So often we use this as a sense of there must be something wrong with me because my brain is telling me that I'm depressed. But actually it's the same as your arm hurting. It's a context of something is not working correctly and we need to change the way that that connects so that it functions better. So to some degree, when we start talking about therapy or psychology, of course, for some people that makes them think that there must be something wrong with them, as opposed to seeing that it's about mental health and wellness, which is also physical health and wellness, and fine-tuning and maintaining and understanding that it's a lifelong experience, continually retuning that brain is something that we would benefit from. So if you change the name, it's great. But I think one of the bigger things is helping people to fundamentally understand that the brain just doesn't know how to communicate apart from with feeling. So instead of being afraid of the feeling, which is what we tend to be, and thinking that it makes something wrong with us, instead we should just acknowledge that that's a way of it messaging us that we need to do something effective for it. I think the fact that you have opt-out therapy is great because it just means that you balance everyone with this understanding that we think you should all need it at some point. I think the biggest problem with therapy is it's middle class. I think that most people can't afford it. And if your work gives it you for free, that's incredible, but it's still exclusive. It's exclusive on two levels. It's exclusive because you've either got to pay for it, which means that most of the population can't get it, or it's exclusive because there's a waiting list and people are queued ahead of you. So what we do know is we miss out the major cogent population who require it.
Yeah. And I would recommend anyone to get it if they can because of the benefit that it's given me. But I understand that there's so many barriers in the way there to get there if you're not fortunate enough to work for somewhere that is so open-minded about
it. Exactly.
And I'm very proud of the fact that we're leading the charge on that and hope many other businesses follow. You mentioned earlier about social media and the rise of that and how that's helped you with your network and enabled you to speak to more people. A question that I get asked a lot working in social media and social media marketing is our responsibility with the rise in conversation around mental health and the comparison narrative that's on Instagram. What are your opinions on social media and mental health?
Such a complex territory. Because it's really easy to say, oh, well, evidence is presenting us with this beauty ideology, which is really negative for us. And we're seeing that that has an impact on mental health and wellness. So, of course, if I expose myself constantly to perfectionistic bodies, am I going to feel good about my less perfectionist body? Probably not. It's kind of a common sense evaluation. But primarily for me, I see social media as something that can do incredible good. I remember working with my first transgendered young person 20 years ago, and they were literally the only person that I'd ever met as a practitioner. That human felt completely isolated. They felt completely unconnected and disconnected to all their peers. Nowadays, they go online and they reach social media and they connect with other people and they realize they're entirely normal and it's okay to be atypical. It doesn't mean that you're any different. It just means that you've got a process to go through to eventuate where you require to be and you belong. So it's really healthy in that respect. I think one of the biggest problems that we've got is that there seems to be this idea of like low accountability and low responsibility. You know, it's our job to know what works for us. Now, I exclude kids and I exclude teenagers from this equation, but kids shouldn't be on social media. If you've got your kids on social media, there are a million reasons why it's bad for them. You know, one of the things is brain development. You know, one of the things is that it means that they're constantly dealing with short attention. One of the things means that they don't know how to self-soothe. So there are all these real negatives that we can actually evidence. But then we go on to teenagers. As a parent, you should know if your kids are under 13 and on social media, because again, we don't give you those references to make you unhappy. We say it's protective. But from then, it has to come from teaching young people that they have a sense of responsibility to their own mental health. Mm. I guess that's where it comes from, education, etc. And social media has got such benefits and ramifications of reaching out. And it has such negatives, but that's because there are good humans and there are average humans. And there are people who are good but don't know how to be good online. And there are people who are bad and want to be bad online. And so there's this massive context of human beings there. But if you expose yourself consistently to things that make you feel unhappy, at some point you're going to have to articulate that that's about you and your desire to beat yourself up constantly. And that isn't the social media that's doing it for you. It's you making that choice. I think that we will always put beautiful people in front of others, and we will always strive to be better, because part of our human instinct is survival DNA. And it says that survival DNA comes to the society you live in. You live in it. What is successful? What is the reality of that blueprint? Right, okay, that's the blueprint, therefore I'll follow that blueprint, but without questioning it. So I think social media is amazing. I think it has massive pitfalls, but I think the bigger thing is, okay, what we know about social media, how do we make it better? How do we make it safer? And how do we teach young people to manage it in a way that means that they're not detrimental to their mental health? And actually adults as well. I mean, there are so many men and women out there who just expose themselves to things that make them feel bad. Mm. And it's like, why don't you just carry on hitting yourself over the head? You don't need to. You can stop that. You can make that choice. You can be accountable to yourself.
How do you think that you recognize that if you get into a cycle of constantly looking at the negatives? Do you think there's a point where you think, oh my God, this is not helping me? Or do you think people just go into it and not recognize it?
Yeah, I think it's 50% of one, 50% of the other, right. I really do. So yeah. I think that you've got a situation where you follow, you know, people follow the Kardashians. They don't follow the Kardashians because they actively think, Khloe's going to make me feel terrible today. You know, they follow the Kardashians because it's a marketing empire and it's done so cleverly, it makes you feel that you're part of that family, right? Mm-hmm. So you're doing it for one set of circumstances that seems to make sense to you. But unequivocally on the other side, you're being pumped consistently with this marketing branding that's making you feel like you have to buy yourself a steam product by product for the rest of your life. You know, that's the premise of it. So somewhere in between that, people have to be educated to know about this so they can make a concerted effort to decide what's right for them. So I kind of think the ambiguity about what you feel you need, what you actually do need, and what you're being forced to need by rights of marketing, for example, is what we need to clarify. And that's a complex equation to work out. But the biggest thing that you have to ask yourself is, like, am I happy? Mm. And am I content? And if you're not, you have to look at the variables in your life that are connecting or interfering or improving that. And that's where you begin.
That's a great tip. So anyone that's really struggling with using social media or any other form of media, because it's not just related to social. No. I've worked in magazines previously.
Oh, and my God, yeah.
The comparison thing there, and it's just on a different platform. People don't change, exactly. Do they?
And also the great thing about social media is that you just get the most amazingly positive people who don't fit the typical beauty or don't fit the typical success. And they exploit that to show humans that actually it's completely okay to be whoever you are. Like, I call myself a dinted tin constantly because, you know, I'm certainly never going to be on the exclusive aisle. I'm much more achievable, but I'm probably going to do exactly the same job as the person who's suggesting that you should go and spend £6,000 doing a weekend away on a reflection course, right? It's about the way that you perceive the world around you. And I think that social media is incredible because it's now allowing us to have perceptions that we wouldn't have seen in magazines.
Yep.
Because in magazines, if you put on 5 pounds, you're going to be on the front in a bikini looking perfectly all right, but it's not going to be good enough. Whereas if I go on social media, there's going to be like a woman who's 2 stone overweight, dead proud of her mummy belly, telling me that it's great to feel healthy. And that gives me a perspective that I don't think magazines and normal media would ever give you.
Mm. Yeah, so it gets a bit of a bad rep, but actually it can be very helpful. I do as well. I wouldn't be working in it, I guess.
Right. Saved me a million ways, social media, yeah. Without a doubt.
It's just that level of support. And I think the next thing I want to talk to you about is opening up, because I found I've got a lot of support from social media when I have opened up. And I know you've been through an incredibly tough year this year.
Yeah.
And you've been brave enough to talk about that really openly. But I want to talk to you about what you found from doing that and what you've also got from that.
Yeah, I mean, I always talk about my social media as my cyber family because I genuinely feel like people care. And I don't just mean it in that flippant, oh, they ask you how you are. I mean, I think they're invested and they care. When my dad killed himself, it had been after a year of him being like so sick and getting sepsis and then kidneys failing and then getting delirium, which is like psychosis, and it just being a catalogue of errors and having to like nurse him with my brother and this consistent, really powerfully devastating and also, you know, powerfully connecting experience, you know, within my family. And my followers had just been following me, and every week when I do my Facebook clinic and people come and ask for help and I get the honor and privilege of sharing information and giving them my advice, and they all connect, and they've been asking about my dad constantly, and then my dad killed himself. And I can remember sitting and my agent was saying, you have to put out a message, you have to put it out to the press, because what's going to happen is you can't go on this morning and be a psychologist doing in a column, you know, on the phones and talking about something specific, and then suddenly somebody goes, hey, Emma's dad killed himself last week. It just won't be effective. You need to put out a family statement. And it's like, I'm not putting out a family statement. I'm not the queen. And it seems really weird to do that. I wouldn't do that as a human being. I've never hidden from anything. So I just did this like minute video to my social network looking like I just lost my dad. Simple as that. Big red eyes, looking so, so sad. And I just said thanks to all of them that followed me on my journey, and I wanted to know how it concluded. And I can remember just like sending it off and not thinking about it, because that was just what I needed to do to clarify that there had been a full stop, simple as that, in front of that. And I can't even tell you how many thousands of messages off people, some within my network, some without my network, all with the same belief, which is, that's a terrible thing to happen. We're so sorry. What can we do to help you? It resonated with people who shared their stories. I've got like probably 1,000 messages from people who are bereaved by suicide, and being able to share those stories and share those journeys and say how shit it is, and also to recognize that, you know, there isn't an answer to any of that. You're just reaching out there and saying, hey, this is my information. Do you want to hold it? And do you want to reflect it? And do you want to nurse it? Do you want to soothe it? And everyone was like, yeah, we do. I didn't have one, not one comment out of thousands of messages, not one that was negative, quite the contrary. And even now today, I get those messages consistently because that message gets seen again and again, as it always will. That's the amazing thing about the cyber world. And those people, every single message I read, they have no idea of its impact, because I think that people sometimes think that, particularly if you're on TV, that you're probably not going to really read your messages. And like, I read every single message and I really, really was comforted by them. And it reminded me that one of the things that grief does, which is really powerful, is it isolates you. It tells you to be alone. It tells you to be quiet. It tells you to be depressed. And I remember always working with emotions as prompts. So when I feel like lonely and isolated, it's about reaching and connecting. And I remember using social media for that. And I credit the way that my journey is right now, which is still incredibly painful. Like, my father was like the most important human in my life. And he was my rock. And he was brought my kids up with me when I was a single mom. And he was just the best man you could have ever met, you know? And I credit them carrying me. Mm-hmm. You know, I really do. And the journey of documentation, Instagramming, and the journey of documentation doing my clinics, it's as much about me, you know, and I own that. I'm not just there saying, hey guys, let me help you. I'm like, guys, this is how I feel. Tell me what I'm doing and reflect that. And I think that arguably for me, social media is one of the most brilliant things that I have in my life. And I feel a genuine connection with those people. And I don't think that they have any understanding of how far the ramifications are mentally for me. Mm. And I don't feel afraid to share everything and anything online. I don't care if you like it or not, you know. Mm. It's your bag to block me, delete me, report me, whatever. It's there to do. But I just love it. Mm. I love my community. Mm. And I feel such a connection because of it with young people and the way that they're changing their communication. The style of communication is shifting. And people who are older need to realize that they're not being minds taken over by computers. They're not. They're just learning a new way to communicate. And part of that is reaching people, right?
Yeah, 100%. There's a couple of bits in there that I want to touch on, because the when I talked about the miscarriage and I did my episode on miscarriage with the charity, I was absolutely petrified to do it. And I felt like if I talked about it and opened it up, I don't know, I didn't know how I'd feel about it. It took me a while to do it. So it took me good 7 months or something to get it, 8 months to get it out. And then I had exactly the same experience as you. As soon as I did, I read all the messages and I just broke down, lost it completely. The tears just flew because I felt this massive sense of relief that not only was I wasn't on my own.
Yeah.
And I had a network of people who either had A, been through it, and it helps them, which is always my driver, is making sure if I'm talking about something openly, I'm helping other people.
Right. You give permission to other people to do the same.
Yeah. And if I can do that with my whatever I have, whatever network I have, then I feel incredibly proud. So it gave me a bit of closure. So I completely resonate with that, and I'm also very proud of what I've done with it.
Yeah.
The other thing is on communication and young people. It's really interesting because Steve and I, Steve's our founder at Social Chain, we are launching something called Perry. So last year, Steve did a video on mental health and suicide, and there was a young person who got in touch with it. He got so many messages. One person that did get in touch with him actually took his own life, and his name was Perry. What we're creating now is, after doing a lot of research and understanding communication between young people, they don't pick up the phone anymore. They're not going to ring. They're not going to ring Samaritans.
Right, yeah.
So we're working on creating a chat bot that, well, it's not a bot, it's a real person, but you can go straight through to talk to someone from social. So in real time, you can have that communication in a way that feels natural to you.
Yeah.
And you can get your help and support. And we're talking to charities at the moment.
That's really
about
good.
That. So
it's a strange thing. I think that human beings have got lost. They see themselves as a separate thing to an animal. They just do. So they literally define themselves as this human being. But like, Homo sapien might be known as wise man, but it's an animal. We're an animal. So we've created a world which goes completely against the nature of what we require. So we look to relationships to answer our needs, where once upon a time we would have looked to our tribe. You know, we live in boxes where once we would have lived together in communities, and we see asking for support as somehow part and parcel of not managing. And yet, once upon a time, it would have been the community that we supported and were supported by that gave our tribe the power to be successful. We've literally annihilated the very things that make consciousness feel good. Mm. And we've isolated ourselves to a point where we now see asking for help as weakness, as opposed to seeing it as a part of being not only a human, but part of a useful, really effective tribe. So when we look at communication, for example, you know, the fact that a young person feels so alone is an absolute testament to a tragedy in society. These are children. I mean, children should not feel alone. Children should not feel excluded. Like, they are basically the foundation of what makes the future. And it's terrifying that kids are killing themselves. And it's happening more and more and more. And suicide is on the rise. You know, my own boys are now 10 times more likely to take their own life because my father did. I'm 10 times more likely to take my life because my father did. And this is something that is endemic in our society. And it's becoming a pandemic to some degree when you think about the figures all around the world. And all it takes, and I mean this, like, it's so, so important that people understand this. All it takes is reaching out. That's it. People can be really severely mentally ill. They can be severely, severely isolated. They can feel like there is no point in genuine. They can have self-harmed. They can have done lots of horrible things to themselves. And when somebody reaches out in that state, or when you think that somebody might be near that state, or when you are concerned about somebody, I cannot tell you the impact of just saying, you know what, I'm going to make you a cup of tea. I'm going to sit down and we're just going to be in this space together. And I talk about that across the board, really. You know, we have suicidal kids. We have kids dependent on drugs. We have kids in horrible situations, and it all comes from pain. You know, we have so many conversations about mental health, but it's from pain. Mm-hmm. What we don't talk about, really, is what's missing in our society to soothe it. There is an antidote to all of this. And it's great that you're going to kind of do that stuff that means that a young person can just at least text something and feel that they've got some kind of response and connection. But I had this, like, really, really powerful belief that everything that we need exists everywhere around us. And yet, for some reason, we're not capitalizing on that in any way. And so we're failing consistently. And we always have the answers. And yet, even though we have the answers, we're being pushed down this other set of circumstances around what makes you happy and what you really need for success. And all of it's bollocks. Absolute bollocks. But the marketing is so powerful. Capitalist belief system and the prerogative and all of that is so powerful that kids are so confused. Mm. And it's one of those things where, like you said, you're standing there with social media saying, look, we can do this for the common good. You know, we can articulate it in a way where we can still sell products, but we can also really, really help to create a more mentally stable society. And it's within our fingertips. It's within our reach. It's like an absolute travesty, a travesty that a child takes their life, a travesty. It's just a complete failing on society. And every single person who hears or reads about it, it's become so commonplace that people are like, oh, yeah, a kid killed themselves. Oh, yeah, a kid threw themselves in front of a train. Oh, yeah, a kid threw himself off a motorway bridge a few weeks ago, right? What? Mm. How have we become so desensitized to this? How have we become so desensitized? This is a child. Mm. Like, it's a child, like, full of possibility and potential. And they snuff it out because no one's dealing with the real issues about their mental health.
Yeah.
And no one realizes that there's nothing wrong with being in pain. And we all use horrible things to resolve it. Like, of course, if you take heroin, it will absolve that pain for a temporary period. Of course, it's highly effective. Highly effective, just not very good, right?
Mm.
So we need to teach people that they don't need to anesthetize the pain. They need to work with it and through it, if that makes sense. Mm. I know that's a really long answer, but I think when we're talking about mental health and picking up a phone and texting or tapping something out on your laptop, it's amazing and that's a brilliant thing you're doing. But I think there's this, like, stark warning to our parents and our society out there, which is, what is happening that we need this? That is insane.
Mm. What would be your tips for parents then with their children now?
I mean, most of the time in the UK, parents are doing an amazing job. The kids that I'd really like to reach, the parents won't be doing a great job.
Mm.
And so unfortunately, it's one of those where the people I'd be advising don't necessarily hear it or take it on. If you have a kid listening to this and you have a parent who's shitty, then just know it won't always be that way. And also don't be afraid to ask and demand help, because think that kids feel powerless. So young teenagers feel powerless. Just keep going, go to social services, refuse to go home. The care system's not great, but if you're having a horrible time at home, it's probably better. Or find a friend whose parents are nice and ask whether you can stay with them. Seriously, do whatever you can, but you will usurp that situation in the end, you will get away. So for those kids, like, just remember that it's shit sometimes. Mm. It really is. Horrible things happen. It doesn't have to be that way. It will be okay in the end. You can make it okay in the end. Your life can be beautiful in the end, but you're just going to have to weather the storm. For parents who've got kids that they're worried about, the most important thing is communication. And from the beginning, don't believe that your child's okay. Everybody does that. They believe their child's okay. I can't believe that this happened because they seemed okay. Of course. Like, what child, what adult, like you've said, when you were in pain, mm-hmm. when you went through your miscarriage, mm-hmm. you didn't walk into the office and just throw yourself on the floor, start crying and say, please, somebody heal me, right? Soothe me. You needed that.
Yeah.
That's what you needed. But you put on your game face. You get on with it. Mm-hmm. You act like you're okay. And then, you know, in the moment where you break down, you allow yourself a moment of it. But really, you've been fundamentally walking around with an earthquake chasm mm-hmm. just about to explode. And you've been managing that. So I think that for parents, it's like constantly check in. I say the 20-minute rule every single day. I give my kids 20 minutes each and we talk about everything and anything, side-by-side communication. Get them out in the fresh air, walk with them, because when you have side-to-side communication, you express and explore things without that real feeling that it's a bit awkward, and it's amazing how that connects. Get them out with nature. They need it. They won't believe they need it. They need it. They're an animal. They need white light on their skin. They need fresh air in their lungs. Digitally detox them. Put those phones away. They should not be on them after 9 o'clock at night if they're going to bed at 11. And 2-hour rule before that, absolutely. Do not feed your kids shit. They will eat a lot of that anyway. Make sure you provide them with a healthy diet. And also, teach them to reframe. The truth is that life is horribly vulnerable and things happen that you would never, ever wish to happen to you. They do, but it's still beautiful. If I were to sit every day and think about the fact of my dad in that garage and me cutting him down and me not being able to resuscitate him and all of the things that were negative, right? If I volumize that, then what have I got apart from this absolute bleakness? That was how I'd be describing it. Bleakness, just suffocating, drowning agony. That's just terrible. Mm. So if instead I can go, the volume on that is present, it's like tinnitus, it's always there. But you know, it doesn't deny or decrease the joy that I have when I hug my children, or the way that that food tastes when I allow myself to enjoy it, or that feeling of connection with the people who are there for me, or my chats on social media with people that I really feel a real strong bond with. They're all still as present. But what we do is we turn the volume up on the worst thing and then we apply ourselves to that. So as a parent, it's your job to help your child see the volume switches on all of those emotions. And also intervene early. You know, get in there and recognize that if they're in pain, demand whatever you need. And don't listen to professionals who tell you that they're all right when you know that they're not. And more than anything, don't be afraid to go against the system. The biggest thing that I would say to a parent out there is, if you've got a kid at school being bullied who hates it, get them out, move them.
Yeah.
Don't fight it. You know what? Lots of kids can be absolute arses to other kids and they go out of their way and they make their life hell. Why should that kid have to go through it? You have an active choice. Educate them at home. Get them online. E-learning. There's amazing e-learning GCSEs now. There's always a different approach. I say don't fight a system. Create an alternative. And if there is an alternative, make one yourself. It's always possible. So all of that I would say to parents. And more than anything, love your kids in spite of themselves. Do not use tough love. It's rubbish. Try not to shout at them, never hit them. All of those things together.
Amazing. That's going to be so useful for people who've got kids and they're listening.
And also you're lucky you've got kids.
Yeah, so yeah, it's definitely. It's interesting what you say about turning stuff up and dialing down the emotion, because I know I can only link it to my experience,
yeah.
But when I started feeling more like myself again, I really valued the feeling of feeling happy and just that feeling of joy, and that definitely had been turned down.
Mm.
But as soon as I started recognizing it again, I didn't appreciate it before. So for me to go through that journey where I was quite low, to come out the other side now, I've got a whole new appreciation on life.
Right.
And the actual feeling of happiness.
But it's also the work that you were willing to put in to allow yourself to see that it can change. Mm. You know, we often apply these enormous generalizations to the way that we feel. So I am depressed. Well, you're not. You have depression, but you are also a myriad of other variables. If you define yourself by this, then you will be it. So I think that when we're going through situations of grief, we're meant to feel bad, because if we have a human quality of caring and compassion, to lose is always tragic. But also we have to see that the very thing that we still have has been denied to others. And what will we do if we don't take full advantage of what we have? For me, every day now, I ask myself, what would my dad want? My dad would absolutely want me to just feel at peace and know I was loved and know that I have learned and to do my best onwards and upwards from this. It doesn't deny the loss, like your child that you lost. It doesn't deny it. In fact, if anything, it gives it more worth and value. And I've miscarried children. Both of my boys are fertility kids. And unfortunately, when you're on that journey and you've not necessarily had it easy in that realm, again, it means that when it comes to processing it, you're always aware of the fact that life is fleeting and it is vulnerable. And sometimes you don't get what you want. But that doesn't mean that your life isn't brilliant beyond measure. It doesn't mean that you're not still incredible and you have this amazing purpose. And I think that we get lost in the stereotypes of expectation about how we think life should be, but it's run on a blueprint that's broken, that someone else created, that really we don't need to complete.
And it's a massive pressure, I think, as women we put on ourselves that you should be married at a certain age and right. You should have kids at a certain age.
Hence my divorce.
Yeah, and it's terrifying, because all my school friends are all married with kids and I turn up to all the parties, just me on my own. And at times I really struggled with that because I felt like I shouldn't be. I felt like I should be somewhere else.
Yeah.
But I don't know how I did it. I managed to reframe my brain and look at what I did have and look at the amazing work that I've done in my career and the fact that it'll come later. I'm just doing it differently.
Exactly. I mean, I think being a woman at this point in time is one of the most interesting, one of the most exciting, and one of the most confusing, because all the stereotypes that used to apply no longer apply. Like, we don't stay at home with our kids. If you do, great, brilliant, amazing. I mean, nice that you can afford it. I just couldn't have afforded it. I think it's brilliant to be a housewife if you get that option, or a house husband. But to some degree, for most of us, it's completely different now. Like, we have a career. We don't actually need a man. Mm. We can just go and have a sperm donor and we can grow our own baby and it's completely acceptable. We can have another person's baby. We can do all these things that we couldn't do before. We can go into business. We can go into corporate world. And we can be absolute contenders. And it's so brilliant. It's knackering, because I think that women are pretty multifaceted. And that means that we think we have to do it all. Like, I've never stopped and thought to myself, oh, it'd just be cool to just be a housewife and stay at home. It's like, that never applied. So it's like, I have to be a housewife whilst also being a career woman, whilst also being a very good mother, and also being a wife, and also being a dog parent, and also looking after the community that I live in. It's like, you want to do it all. It's not even a bad thing. It's a great thing. It's like the most powerfully moving experience to be a female in this time. Like, I think we're the luckiest. I genuinely do. I think this is the time, and I think your generation and the generation that comes after are even luckier, because it's just so, so possible. It's possible. And it's mind-blowing for me now to kind of live in this blink of an eye of consciousness at a time where we're in one of the luckiest countries in the world, living a life where we're free with all these possibilities. Mm. But it's hard being a woman. That's why they have stupid names like female founders. Speak to our female founders, because misogyny still exists.
Yeah.
And chauvinism still exists. Yeah. And the business place is still not a place where women have equality. But we are getting there.
Oh, I hate it. I hate going to female networks.
Don't, can't bear it.
I shouldn't say this, but I hate female networking
right
events.
To do that.
I hate them.
I'm with you.
Oh, I just feel like it's a room full of women moaning about men.
I love men.
So do I. All the way through my childhood, my closest friends were boys.
And also, right, I never in my life have felt held back by a man.
Yeah.
And so, I know loads of people, I agree, they'll be like, oh my God, there's two women in a room. She's got blonde hair, that's why she's saying it. You know who like men, had it easy. No, it's not that at all. It's that, I tell you what I genuinely think it is. Having been working on an app for a long time, and far too long actually, should have been launched years ago, but having been building this, and part of it is the investment process, right? That's the reality. It's class.
Mm.
This world has got nothing to do with men and women being problems. It's to do with class. It's to do with wealth. It's to do with people keeping you out because you don't come from the right postcode, right? Now, that's a problem. Mm. You can put me in a room with as many men and women as you want, as long as they haven't come from a position of being very wealthy. If they're very wealthy, we will not connect and we will feel different because you think I'm different because I did not go to the right place, right? I did not go to Eton. Mm. I did not go to Oxford and Cambridge. I didn't go. But as far as men go on the level, they're brilliant. And I found men being one of the most, yeah, one of the most growing parts of who I am is because I'm surrounded by great men. Yep. And women. I love women.
Yeah, I know.
But yeah, I'm like, my heart sinks and they go, let me introduce you to the female founder. I'm like, do you have to?
I know.
Can we just meet the person who's just going to say yes or no? Yeah, whoever they are, gender-wise.
I know. Right. It's crazy. So we can move then on nicely to the office because there are... working with a lot of young people in this office like we do, our average age is probably about 26 now. At one point it was 22, so wow. Very young. and we are all incredibly ambitious and we all want to do the best we can, but there is a struggle between work-life balance.
Right.
And I wondered if you had any tips for people on how to get the best work-life balance.
I mean, I think one of the most important things with work-life balance is know the right employer. So like people who are here have already kind of hit the nail on the head by getting somebody who appreciates the therapeutic value of looking after staff. So know your employer. Secondly, recognize that long hours do not mean high productivity. And it's far better to be honest with your boss and have a conversation about when you work best, how you work best, and know what you're meant to be working towards so that if you do it in a faster time, you can create space for yourself. I think that it's really, really powerful to look after the self fully. What I say all the time to people who get really bored of listening is what you put in your body is important, what you do with your body is powerful. So if you're not eating a good diet, if you're not looking after yourself physically, then you're not going to be able to look after yourself mentally. So if you start essentially with the foundation, which is how do I create the best output for my body and self, that comes down to what you're eating and what you're doing and whether you're drinking heavily and all those things that go with it. From the point of being a perfect person in that position, I don't drink alcohol now, I don't smoke cigarettes, I exercise regularly. It's not because I think that that's cool, it's because I need my energy levels to be set. So I think as a young person, it's really easy to think you're invincible. I do remember that. Mm. And you've got to recognize you're not. And you've also got to recognize if you want to work at your best and do the best and be the best, you have to apply that rule to yourself. And then also asking for support, making sure that you work in a way that's flexible enough for yourself and knowing that you're not competing with anybody else apart from yourself and your own journey. I think a lot of people look to the side and go, they seem to be better at A, B, and C. I learned Pareto's law years ago, and it basically is an economic law by a philosopher. And it says that 80% of your success comes from 20% of your actions. And that was life-changing for me. I remember thinking, oh, that's really interesting. 80% of what I do that brings me most success, 80% of what success I have comes from this little 20%. And it was right. It was communication. Like, I hated a lot of the stuff I did. But I love communication. I love listening to people. I love problems. I love solutions. I love, like, conversing. I even love conversing with people, whether it's outside of therapy or otherwise. And I just sat there and I was like, well, what if I just do that? And so I left my job and I did that. And within the first few years, I was earning 3 times what I'd ever earned in my job. Why? Because I just applied what I was good at. And I think that in the offices, if we know we're really good at something and we're really productive at that, we should bring it to the attention of our employers so that we say, I'm really great at this and look at this productivity and the amazing stuff I'm doing. And look at how if I don't do that, the bit that slows me down, all of this gets done. Because that makes you ingenuity level high, it makes you creativity level high, it makes you be able to speak to your boss in a way that proves and evidences it, and it means you work harder and smarter in a certain capacity, which means you have more free time, all that. Mm. But the most important thing is to realize do what makes you happy. Mm. And I mean that. I think that what you were talking about a moment ago was really powerful. It's that sense of, for such a long time we're asleep, and I think we really are. You go through this Western belief system and it goes, right, you're at home for a bit, you go to nursery, you go to preschool, then you go to school, then you go to high school, then you go to college, then you go to university if you're lucky, then you get a job, then you get married, and then you have kids, and then you save for your pension, then you die. And that's the way it works. It's a horrible, horrible, horrible equation that we've been living for years. It's been broken forever. It's like, look at the rates of divorce. It's massively broken. Look at dysfunction, hugely broken. Look at men handle. It's ruined this system. It doesn't work. And yet, we still do it because somebody said that that was the way to do it. And it's like, wake up. And that thing that you're saying of coming to parties now and going, actually, you know what? I don't have to be at this age a mum. I can actually be a career woman. I can be boss in my life. And in 5, 10 years, I can still go ahead and do it because thank you, fertility rules. You know, I can freeze my eggs. I can do whatever I want. And we've got all of these new systems, social media, all of these things that are kind of there. And yet we're still living by this old set of rules. So I think the other thing is make yourself apply your talents to things that you really think you would love, and you will be more successful than counterparts who are not naturally inclined. So I think it's crazy at school when somebody says, I want to be an actor, and the teacher says, okay, but what do you want to do for a real job?
Mm.
You know, how can you do that? How can you destroy people's dreams?
Yeah. Crazy. We see it as leaders as well. And I think it's important for leaders on the flip side to really look and listen to people.
Right.
Because you can see when someone's really engaged and really happy and really motivated in what they're doing. And then it's your job then to facilitate that move into getting them there. And that's something that we all, I think, as leaders need to work on.
So true. I remember watching somebody when I was managing a mental health service. And she was so pernicious over admin. She was incredible. And it was something over envelopes. And I was like, why are you so bothered? And she was like, I love admin and I love envelopes. And I was like, I'm just going to let her do all that shit. And she did it brilliantly. And suddenly I was like, there are people out there who love admin.
Yeah.
And it was this thing where we go through life thinking everybody else loves the bits you love. And it's rubbish. They don't. Mm. So just apply the things that you love. And always know as well that if it doesn't work out, it really doesn't matter.
Mm.
I see the world as this massive playground. I really do. I tell people constantly I haven't decided what I want to be when I grow up yet. Because I don't know. You know, I might want to go and join the circus.
Mm.
That might happen one day. I might want to go and do something completely different. I don't want to see this life as a linear journey where we're all on a treadmill going a certain direction where we don't really know because we've assumed that that was what you had to do. Who says so? Who says so? The reason we're unhappy, the reason that we're not succeeding most of the time is because we're just in the wrong fit. Anybody knows what it's like to wear clothing 2 sizes too small. It's bloody uncomfortable and it won't make us happy and we certainly won't be doing our best. But you get the right fit, even better. You get something that's nice and comfy as well, and very durable.
Yeah.
Off you go.
Nice and cozy. No, I love that. Every week, my favourite part of my podcast is where I get people to send in admission submissions. And there's a few that have come through that I think I'm definitely not well placed to answer, but I know you will be coming from your background. So I will read them out if that's
great,
all right, and see
it.
What your thoughts are. So, hey, Katie, I'm a sufferer of seasonal depression, and I wonder if you had any advice on how to maintain motivation within work for those darker months.
Okay. So seasonal depression or seasonal affective disorder, it's 2 levels. So we've got seasonal affective disorder, which is clinical, which means that you might have seen a psychologist or a psychiatrist and been assessed, and you might be given a certain amount of drugs to deal with that, maybe antidepressants, there might be some kind of nutritional aspects that you've been told to look after. And if that's the case, you know, if you've got those on top of everything else that I'm going to suggest, great. If, however, you're talking about, I notice that I get really low when it's the months that are dark, that's called subsyndromal SAD. And a lot of us get that.
Mm.
And it's characterized by firstly recognizing that you feel exhausted. Secondly, you might want to go for loads of sugary and carby food. You know, you just feel that need to just eat something stodgy. Often you lose interest in things like sex, exercise, life, and you feel exhausted. And again, a lot of people will say to themselves, I'm just not doing a good enough job because I'm this exhausted, I'm this unhappy. But you have to remember you're an animal. So basically, one of the problems you've got there is the melatonin levels in your brain are being incorrectly secreted. So they're either being overproduced, and that means that you're going to feel sluggish and exhausted. So you've got to bring that back. So there's a few things you can do. You can get a phototherapy box about 40 minutes in the morning and at night. It'll help to regulate the levels of light getting into the brain. You can also get ear. Now, this is great for the younger generation. For the younger generation, there are now earplugs that you can put in, and it generates this sun to the brain. You need it for about 12 minutes. Quite expensive, about 130 quid, but they are available.
Yeah.
And as I said, the other thing that you can do that you can't beat, in spite of these amazing creations, is in your dinner hour or at home, whatever, it doesn't matter, get out for an hour. You can't get out for 20 minutes. If you go online, it'll say, get out for 20 minutes. No, if you're at the equator, you can do that. In the darker months, you need to be out for a good hour, get the white light on your skin or the blue light. And also, a few hours before bed, do not use your technology because the light that is created from it, it's like a blue light, and that tricks the brain into thinking that, you know, you're creating certain chemicals that you shouldn't be creating, which makes you feel exhausted and not sleep still. So it kind of is this awful cycle. So have 2 hours at least without lots of leafy greens, lots of things like blueberries and raspberries. And if you eat fish, lots of oil. All of those things can really help. Then there are things you can do. You know, you can buy online herbal remedies as well that can be effective. But I'd try all of that. The main thing is to remember that if it's getting to a point where it's really affecting you and you just feel like it's more than can be managed with exercise and diet and getting that kind of light, just go and see your GP. For some people, it can be quite catastrophic those months.
Mm. Oh, they're great. I need to stop looking at my phone before I go to sleep. I'm really bad for it.
Everybody goes, use it as an alarm. So we trick ourselves. We've got a bias, have a way, but it's all right. It's just my alarm. And then you're on the Daily Mail app going, oh, why are they so right-wing?
Yeah. Yeah. And then reading stuff about podcasts that I sent to Dodson. I shouldn't do. I need to stop.
I love that.
Next one is something actually that's quite close to my heart at the moment, is that I shouldn't say this, but I hate Christmas. I feel like my anxiety and depression gets worse around Christmas, and I don't know why. But I was wondering if the people at Social Chain suffer from the same thing and how you deal with it. And the reason why it's quite close to my heart is that my miscarriage was on Christmas Eve. So for me, I don't know if this is the right thing, and I'm hoping you can tell me. I'm trying to make positive memories for Christmas Eve and the days coming up to it, but it's hard. It's really hard to try, and you've got those memories of what happened, and I think you've said before about firsts, so I'd like a bit of help with this as well.
I think the thing about Christmas is it's a juxtaposition to everything we feel when we're grieving or when we're unhappy, right? Everybody's going to be thrilled, everybody's going to be excited, everybody's going to get their dreams come true, everybody's getting pissed, everyone's going to parties, everyone's socialising, and there's this pressure fundamentally to act like you're happy, and your world's falling apart sometimes. I think for anybody who is feeling unhappy with the whole scenario, because obviously she's not said why she is unhappy, but let's just take it that she hasn't got a lot of family and there isn't that sense of connection, so she's not feeling cradled. I think that a lot of people don't feel cradled in their communities. I think remember your incredible power. So first of all, volunteering, literally, it's brilliant. One, you help your community, but secondly, you feel better. We know that the mental health rates of volunteers is powerful. I volunteer loads. Why? Because the feedback is really important for my mental health. So absolutely, I would get her to maybe look at a soup project, something to help the homeless, going and helping get an old people's home, doing something where she sees her value and her power, because we forget it. Secondly, don't feel any pressure to do things the way that everybody else is doing. If you want to watch a boxer and drink a bottle of sherry whilst eating After Eight mints, knock yourself out, because that's completely acceptable. I use a lot of time off at Christmas because I only have a few days like you. We're very busy. I do my life admin. This year I'll be doing more of that because I need a distraction. You cannot be getting outside and going being with nature. You can't, because it's incredible how it just carries on in spite of the fact that everybody else is eating turkey. So go outside and practice some mindfulness as well. I think the most important thing to remember is when we feel helpless and hopeless, we feel not very valuable, we don't really notice our worth, and we don't have a family who connect us and remind of us that, we need to do the work ourselves. There will be people in her locality who would love a knock on the door. There'll be an old age pensioner who has no family, whose life you will change in that moment. So when we're introspective, often we feel unhappy. When instead we externalize our power and we go and do something purposeful, we not only willfully change our own state, we change other people's. So that's something that I think would be really, really helpful. And if you are like me, you're going through your first Christmas like you, where we're grieving a pretty catastrophic loss. First of all, change the tradition. I have it every year. So I've been doing Christmas my whole life for like 15 years now. My whole family come to me. So this year we won't be doing it the same. It's going to be a very different Christmas. I've got a single mum with her two kids coming on top of my own family. We're going to go and do things that are completely non-traditional. And we're going to allow ourselves a lot of time to cry, a lot of time to talk about my dad with you. It's going to be about the things that didn't happen. This would have been your first Christmas with your baby, you know, like you would have been there celebrating all of those things. It's been denied you. But at the same point, it's like every moment of that pain, it has such meaning. I always say, like, grief is love in disguise. You shouldn't hide from it. You shouldn't run from it. It's beautiful. It's like an exquisite grief, isn't it? It's like, it's there and it's powerful and it's poignant and it's real. And every single drop of it is connected to something of deep importance and meaning. And we should never feel afraid of acknowledging that and embracing it. It makes you a good human when you feel that way. And yeah, so I suppose finally as well, if you're really struggling, you don't feel like you've got people around you, just put something on Facebook, put something on Twitter, put something on Instagram. Because I tell you what, honestly, you'll be amazed. Mm. And with people reaching in to cradle you.
Yeah.
So don't feel like you have to do it traditionally, and don't feel like you have to be alone in spite of your pain.
Mm. I think you said something before about how grief has helped deepen relationships with your family.
God, yeah.
And I can totally appreciate that. You realise how much closer you are when you go through something so horrific that you end up with such a connection with your family, don't you? So
yeah, and also it sounds like for you, the connection was always there. You just didn't necessarily take advantage of it or see it.
Yeah.
And don't you think that that's one of the big problems that goes back to what I was saying about community, that often people are so willing to share your pain and we just don't ask them to. We're so aware of how huge it feels for us. We're so aware of how we're going to suffocate if we start talking about it, that it gives us like an asthma. We can't connect it. We can't breathe through it. And then when you just say to somebody, just I'm really struggling, like how many people run off in the other direction? Pretty much 100% of people are like, mate, of course you are. I don't know what to say. Shall I make you a cup of tea? And in that instant, you feel like, yeah, I'm okay. I can do this. I can do this, you know?
Yeah.
I talk about in those early stages of grief, you know, the moment you wake up in the morning, you just have dread, utter dread. And like, it's like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do another day. And then it's like, right, what do I need? How do I reassess this? How do I get myself together? You know, 2 cups of coffee. Have a cuddle with my husband, remind myself of all the beautiful things. Off we go. It's there. And for people who don't have it there, create it because it is there. Like I said, the brilliant thing about social media, it's there in its bucketfuls. Beautiful people desperate to reach out.
Mm.
And if we all did it more, we'd just be so much happier.
Yeah, and breaking it down, those little things you can do in the morning just to
like
those little achievements. Yeah, just makes you feel like you've done something that you can then get through the rest of the day.
Yeah, you're right.
The final question that we've had is all about females in the workplace, which we've touched on a little bit already. And as a female listener to your podcast, I wondered if you had any advice about how to stand out in business, fearful of the glass ceiling, and I'd love to smash it. I'm worried that I'm looked down upon just because I'm a woman. And I really struggle with answering this because I've never felt like I've been discriminated against because of my gender.
Yeah, I mean, I'll instantly know the kind of environments that she's working in because I know I've gone and taught some of them. So when you've been in corporate environments in particular, you can kind of really feel that because they're still like in the 1940s. It's changing. It's not changing quick enough, but it will get there. I think one of the most important things as a woman is the way you perceive yourself. If you perceive a glass ceiling, if you believe that that is there, and if you believe that people are prejudiced towards you, you will internalize that. It will affect your confidence, and in the way that you wish it not to, it will mean that your output is not as it should be. It's like the imposter syndrome kind of scenario where people are just so humble that they aren't able to say that they deserve what they have. So we kind of have to look at ourselves and say, okay, you know what, if I internalize this glass ceiling, if I see it, then it's there. Even if it's transparent, it's there. So if you want to smash it, you have to smash it before you even begin to move forward in that level of confidence. So first of all, I would say, look, in your work environment, maybe there is a ceiling that you perceive is more difficult to smash. So is it the place that you want to be? Because there's no harm in moving to a place where you see that there's more opportunity. Secondly, as a woman, you have to be brasher, you have to be louder. You have to be better, and that's okay. Because believe me, whatever job you're doing, you'll pay dividends by being all of those things. So also, how can you articulate the work that you do in a way that progresses you further by being better at your counterparts? And you have to be. It's as simple as that. If you've got loads of men in your office who are all given positive strokes for being, at times, shall we say, a little bit more out there than their female counterparts, you have to play that game. Mm. You don't have to equal them in their manner, but you have to equal them in your output. So look at how you can solidify the talents that you have and then volumize those to a position where people are noticing you. Also, ask. There is so much evidence in the corporate world that men get raises and get promotions because they ask. So if you're not going and seeing your boss and saying, do you know what? I have seen John in this department. I'm doing more than him. I can evidence it here. Mm. He's earning more than me. And also he got a raise and a new title because he was doing A, B and C. Can you explain to me why when I'm doing all of this and more, you haven't done that for me? So you put yourself in a position where you are heard. You identify the objectives that you have fulfilled, which mean that you should get more, and you determine why and what you are aiming for. So I want this job, I want it in this time, and I expect you to give it me because of all this amazing stuff that I've done. And women have a real problem with saying that. But if you have the argument and you have the credentials and you have the ammunition and your evidence, there's nothing that they can do. So the glass ceiling, I'm not saying there isn't always a bit of a glass ceiling. Like there's always in certain circumstances one for a reason. Like for example, you'll only be able to get a raise to a certain level and you'll have to move on. So again, you know, determine whether the glass ceiling is self-imposed, imposed because it's actually a systematic issue, or it is to do with the culture, in which case, obviously, you have to smash it. So do all those things.
Amazing. I'm sure that's going to be really super.
Or do what
super
I do
helpful.
And just leave and work for yourself.
Yeah, you could do that.
So that you don't have this, you just create a whole new environment because it's miles easier. Yeah.
Smash it for yourself. That wraps up the podcast. I just want to say a massive thank you
for being so
useful, but also so open and honest as well. I think it's been an incredible podcast. I can't wait for everyone's feedback on it.
That's really kind.
And I can't wait for the app to launch.
Well, yeah, like hopefully Appy will be great one day in the next few weeks to month. Yeah, we'll see. But like you said, one of the most important things to leave with is the idea that there's a really powerful thing in therapy called autoethnographic research, and it's us telling stories about our lives to others. I think you doing that to your listeners and me sharing with you, it becomes part of their story, they share their own, and we become part of the same community. It's so powerful. So thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you so much.